thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's March 2023, and this is episode 333, which is a conversation about talking about Christianity with Mormons who are also known as members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or LDS. Today's guest is Clay Jones, who is a visiting scholar for the MA Apologetics Program at Talbot Seminary, and he is also the chairman of the board of Ratio Christi, which is a university apologetics ministry. Clay has written an online exclusive Effective Evangelism feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and his article is called A Question Mormons Can't Answer. Now, for our newer listeners, our Effective Evangelism column really is a very practical advice column, and we have our authors with experience in witnessing to adherents of a particular non-Christian or maybe an Orthodox belief system or group share their knowledge and wisdom on approaches to breaking through the barriers that Christians commonly encounter with that group when discussing Christianity and how it differs from that group's beliefs. So our authors might share some general tips on how to engage with these particular folks, or they might explore a particular evangelistic tactic like we're going to talk about today that has proven effective and it helps in overcoming particular challenge when having discussions with those members of that particular group. Now, I want to tell you once again that our subscribers can read Clay's article for free at our website, equip.org. I do have some sobering news to share with our listeners with regard to Clay. He is a very long-time contributor to the Christian Research Journal and has recently received a diagnosis of stage 4 cancer. So I want to ask Clay about that, and I want to tell our listeners about it so that you can be praying for Clay as he goes through his treatment and as he is living with this cancer diagnosis right now. So we want you to be praying for him.
Thank you for asking about this, Melanie. A few weeks ago, I was diagnosed as having metastasized lung cancer. At least that's what they think it is right now. We are waiting for the genetic profile to come in from biopsies, and because that will allow them to target the cancer, whatever kind of cancer I have, much more efficiently. And our major prayer request is just that we would get a molecular profile that is shows that the cancer is treatable, because a lot of lung cancers are very treatable. And so that's my prayer request, is that we would come up with a lung cancer, whatever it is, that the molecular profile would show that it's very treatable. How I'm doing emotionally is, frankly, we're doing fine. I'm not saying it isn't stressful. Of course it's stressful. But I think that, you know, as you know, Melanie, I've written a book, Why Does God Allow Evil? And I've even written a book on death. You've interviewed me on both these and stuff, written called Immortal, How the Fear of Death Drives Us and What We Can Do About It. And by that, I'm just saying I have a theology of suffering. Especially my book on evil develops why we suffer and how we can triumph in suffering. And so I'm not saying that it's not stressful. I'm not saying that there haven't been some teary times. There are, but something that I think that a lot more Christians need is a good theology of suffering. And just one last comment about that, and it is, I like to tell my classes this all the time. God's plan A for your life is to take you through regular periods of suffering, and there is no plan B. So suffering's a part of the Christian life. We should expect it. God certainly intends to have it be a part of our lives. In fact, Paul said in Romans 5, we rejoice in our suffering, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope. And I've had cancer 19 years ago. I had bone cancer. One of the best things that ever happened to me. I was, you know, thankfully surgically healed from that. I haven't had any problems since. But now here I am with a different kind of cancer. But God is going to use this for our good. And there's never been a time in Jeannie and my life when we've gone through something hard that God hasn't worked it out for our good. And he certainly did that 19 years ago. And we absolutely expect him to do that now. So anyway, thank you for asking.
Well, as I mentioned, Clay has written an article for us about Mormonism. Now, that's something we have published on quite extensively in the past throughout the more than 40-year history of the Christian Research Journal, but a lot less more recently. And I think also I just want to say that we have Mormonism in the title, but the Mormon Church has really in the last 10 years, I'd say, embraced a different way of expressing who they are. So they kind of have moved away from Mormonism and more to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and referring to themselves as Christians. So some people might be newer to apologetics that listen to this podcast or have stumbled on this podcast because of some of the cultural apologetics that we do. And this is more classical apologetics in religion. And they may not be familiar with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or LDS. Now, I noticed even on social media, some people who have gone viral, I could just tell from just different like things in their living room. I think these folks are maybe Mormon. And then I looked at their bio, LDS, and it doesn't say the word Mormon at all. And so because of that, just even because of social media, a lot of like people are promoting Mormonism. I noticed this young kid, his bio was LDS, and I think he's a teenager, and he and his dad do viral dances. And so his link goes to the Mormon Church, LDS. And so why don't you tell our listeners, what is LDS in a nutshell? Because again, some people who are not religious might be stumbling across his TikTok and then seeing, oh, what's this? This looks interesting. This guy's clean cut and he seems like he's a Christian.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, of course, the Latter-day Saints started when Joseph Smith, when Joseph Smith was 15, and that's in 1820, he said the two personages who he later described as God the Father and Jesus Christ appeared to him. Then just 3 years later, he was only 15 with that first one. 3 years later, he said that he was visited by an angel who directed him to a buried book of golden plates inscribed with the Judeo-Christian history of an ancient American civilization. In 1830, then Smith published an English translation of these plates called the Book of Mormon. And that year he organized the Church of Christ, calling it a restoration of the early Christian church. And members of the church were later called Latter-day Saints or Mormons. And then in 1838, Smith announced the name of the church, renaming it as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And so that's what happened here. But as we're going to talk about soon, they are very, very different than what evangelical Christianity would say is a Christian.
So you were talking about Joseph Smith, and just so our listeners know, that is the person who founded the Mormon Church. And I want to ask you next about their particular religious books, because another way that people might have encountered Mormons, LDS, is that they might have received a doorbell ring or a knock on the door from people who are members of the Mormon Church, usually young men who come and talk to you about Mormonism. And so they will say that they hold to the Bible, but they also hold to other books. And one of those books that I want to ask you about is called the Book of Mormon. Now, some of our listeners might have heard about the Book of Mormon without realizing what it is exactly because of the very successful Broadway play called the Book of Mormon. So what are the Mormon scriptures and are they related to the Bible?
Well, yeah, kind of. I mean, of course, they believe the first Mormon scripture is the Bible. And so obviously you're going to have, if you recognize the Bible as being inspired as Mormons do, then they're going to consider the other books, of course, to be related to the Bible. You know, I went to the LDS website because I thought, you know, let's just see how they describe the Book of Mormon themselves. And this is how you find it if you go to the LDS's own website. It says the Book of Mormon is a volume of Holy Scripture comparable to the Bible. It's a record of God's dealing with ancient inhabitants of the Americas and contains the fullness of the everlasting gospel. It's interesting because as they go on and they say the book was written by ancient prophets, by a spirit of prophecy and revelation, their words were written on gold plates. And the record gives an account. This is what's interesting. The record gives an account of two great civilizations. One came from Jerusalem in 600 BC and afterwards separated into two nations known as Nephites and Lamanites. The other came much earlier when the Lord confounded the tongues of the Tower of Babel. And this group, known as the Jaredites, after thousands of years, all were destroyed except the Lamanites, and they are among the ancestors of the American Indians. Now, what's interesting about that, and the reason I wanted to read that, it's, well, it's succinct, that's one reason. But the other reason I wanted to point out is, notice they're saying these, the Lamanites anyway, lived in the United States. But we have no archaeological evidence whatsoever of them, none, not any at all. And I think that's interesting. And so there's the Book of Mormon, then there's Doctrine and Covenants. And the Doctrine and Covenants, it's interesting, is written by Joseph Smith Jr. And they, the Mormon Church, the LDS Church, says that it's a collection of divine revelations and inspired declarations by Joseph Smith Jr. or the first prophet and others who were issued some of his successors in the presidency. Others were issued, I should say, through some of his successors in the presidency. In other words, some presidents in the Mormon Church since Joseph Smith Jr. passed away are able to have given things that are considered scripture. The last one's the Pearl of Great Price. And they put it as, it's a selection of choice materials touching significant aspects of faith and doctrine. And I think that's about, you know, I mean, these items were translated and produced by the prophet Joseph Smith, and most were published in the church periodicals of his day. One of the reasons, by the way, I like quoting what, you know, if you say, well, what do the Mormons think about their own book? And that's what Mormons are saying about their own inspired scripture.
And I do think that there is a possibility that our listeners would come across a Book of Mormon, even if they're not religious, because I was just in the last few weeks staying in a Marriott hotel, and right next to the Bible, there was a Book of Mormon. So it's, you know, there is opportunity for maybe some of our listeners or people that they know to come across a Book of Mormon, even if they do not know a Mormon, just because you can find them in a Marriott hotel, for example. Well, I just wanted to ask you then, in light of that, because you just mentioned that there's no archaeological evidence for some of the claims of, you know, ancient Americas that's in the Book of Mormon. So what are some of the other major differences between people who are LDS and who are Christians and Christianity? What's the difference between Mormonism and Christianity? Is there a difference?
There surely is a big difference. One is that they diminish the reliability of the Bible. And here's what Mormons believe about the reliability of the Bible, again, from their own website. See, somebody can't say, well, you misrepresented them. No, this is from their website. It says, we believe the Bible to be the Word of God as far as it is translated correctly. And it goes on and says, in Joseph Smith's day, the word translate didn't just mean to take something from one language into another. It could also mean to transfer, convey, interpret, or explain. And although errors do appear in the various renderings from the original Hebrew and Greek, the bigger issue is the delivery of the ancient text to the present day. Many plain and precious things were taken away. So as the Bible texts were transmitted to us, certain teachings were lost. That's one reason people have so many different interpretations of the Bible, as Joseph Smith experienced. So one way modern revelation, and by that he means Pearl of Great Price, Doctrine of Covenants, and the Book of Mormon. So one way modern revelation helps clarify and confirm the truths of the Bible by restoring other truths that were lost. And so we'll talk more about that later, about the reliability of the transmission of the Bible. But that's one of the first things. They don't think the Bible, well, it's reliable as long as it's been accurately transmitted. But how do you know whether it's been accurately transmitted? Well, the Book of Mormon and the Pearl of Great Price and Doctrine and Covenants tells you what it should say. Anyway, that's the first thing. The second thing, and this is one I think your listeners are going to really relate to, they believe there are many gods and that Mormon males will one day become gods. Joseph Smith put it this way, God himself was once as we are now and is an exalted man. We have imagined and supposed that God was God from all eternity. I will refute that idea. I will take away the veil so that you may see. Similarly, the prophet Lorenzo Snow put it, as God, man is, God once was. As God is, man may be. And one more quote, former President Spencer Kimball put it this way, brethren, 225,000 of you are here tonight. I suppose 225,000 of you may become gods. There seems plenty of space out there in the universe, and the Lord has proved that he knows how to do it. Anyway, I think that's, obviously, Christians do not believe that there's thousands of gods. If anything, that sounds a lot more like, Hinduism.
And because of that, one thing that is a distinctive of Christianity is that we hold to God being Trinitarian, which Mormons do not.
Right. They don't, indeed. One of the things that I, just to point out, just give a couple of verses here. Deuteronomy 32:39 says, see now that I, even I am he, and there's no God beside me. Isaiah 44:6 says, I am the first and I am the last. Apart from me, there's no God. And I'll just give one more verse about this. In John 17:3, Jesus said, and this is eternal life, that they know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ whom you've sent. I've used that verse a lot with Jehovah's Witnesses, by the way, because if there's only one true God, it says the only true God, how do you get out of that? In other words, if you're going to call yourself a God, then you're in this rather sticky situation of going, well, then you must be a false God, because Jesus said only true God. But see, now again, that's where they go, well, that part wasn't accurately transmitted. So that's how they get out of it. And then the third doctrine that's really sad to me is they believe, as the Book of Mormon says, that by grace you are saved after all we can do. Wow. In other words, you better work really hard, because if you didn't do enough, then grace isn't there for you. You need to, it's saved after all we can do. Well, in other words, you're saved by your works, at least partially by your works.
So I just want our listeners to know, we have a lot of material on Mormonism, but we'll just put some links in addition to the link to Clay's article. We'll put some additional links for just some intro kind of articles and some helpful articles in terms of evangelism, because that is very true. And also, I don't think they look at the idea of sin as it's presented in the Bible as Christians do, specifically when you said you're just quoting them. You know, you have to do everything that you can do to be good. And also, they do not hold to the same way that Christians do in the Bible teaches about the afterlife. They have different, you know, levels of things. We're not going to get into all of those details, but I just wanted Clay to go over some of the basics, because they have had some marketing campaigns in the last several years to show that an LDS is a Christian. Yeah. And so we want to make the distinction, even according to their own website, if you go and look into it further. I'm going to ask once again that you give us the gift of your time to go on and review and rate this podcast on Apple Podcasts, because that's the main platform where podcasts are rated and reviewed. And the last one we had was way back at the beginning of September 2022. So we've had a little bit of a long spell without reviews, and we really would appreciate it, because it's the best way, without any effort really, that the internet will recommend this podcast to other people. And so if you're a faithful listener and you haven't already done so, please go on over there. Now, of course, a starred rating is just great, but even better is a short sentence or two about why you like this podcast. And of course, just get the word out. Tell a friend. Link your favorite, you know, episodes on your social media accounts. We'd be very grateful. And you can always give us a tip for this podcast as well. If you go to equip.org and you go to journal, if you see Postmodern Realities, there is a landing page for all 333 episodes. And on that landing page, you will find a link where you can give us a tip. So we are grateful for your partnership. Thank you for helping us out. Now, I wanted to ask you about this, because you once said that you studied Mormonism, you know, had an in-depth study of Mormonism, but that you're no longer, you know, really keeping up with every little kind of new thing that they're doing or just the details, the fine details of their faith and their doctrines. So is, you know, we just talked about how, you know, the, some of the differences, but is being really intimately familiar with all of Mormon doctrine or the LDS website, is that important as Christians engage with them?
I don't think it is. And yeah, by the way, I was thinking about this. The person that really got me into this was Walter Martin, who, of course, was the founder of the Christian Research Institute. And I think I bugged Martin, Dr. Martin, constantly. Here I was a teenager. I was constantly asking him questions. But anyway, and so I was a teenager and young adult. I was really studying Mormonism, Jehovah's Witnesses and stuff. But I found that that's no longer necessary to know about all these doctrines. For instance, because knowing about a lot of the doctrines, if you argue with a Mormon about it, that's not going to be enough to keep them from being a Mormon. They're not going to stop being a Mormon. For instance, it would be like, and I've argued with debated Jehovah's Witnesses, and I've argued and debated with Mormons. It would be like arguing with a Jehovah's Witness about whether they should celebrate Christmas because they don't believe they should celebrate Christmas. But what do you get if you convince them that it's okay to celebrate Christmas? It's not very important. And so one of the things that I think that we need to do is learn what's the thing that's going to make the biggest difference in a Mormon's thought. What's the very biggest thing that's going to make a difference? And just stick with that. Don't get off into, you know, I mean, whether or not Mormons are going to have many wives in the future or not is not very important. So anyway, so the first reason is I only want to hit them with the one thing that's really important. And honestly, there's another reason I don't do it, because it's honest to stay up with all of their doctrines is just too much work, unless you're going to be a missionary to Mormons and that's going to be your, avocation or vocation. It's too much work. And I'll give an example of this. I used to play chess a lot. I used to really enjoy the game. I don't play it anymore, but I used to. And I one day decided to start reading books on chess. And I found very quickly that when I would play the average, like my neighbor, nobody that's really played chess on any serious level, I would beat them pretty easily. But what I found out is in reading these books is chess masters will memorize basically the strengths and weaknesses and how every opening goes. And there's lots of different openings for chess. The Nimzo Indian is one. Another one, which is one that I decided to study, is Queen's Gambit. But the chess masters will study these many, many different openings and get them down so they see the weakness, because even these chess masters don't have the brain power to figure it out, you know, by just on the spot. So what I decided to do is I thought, I'm never going to memorize all these openings. I've got a pretty good memory, but it's definitely not that good. So what I decided is to just memorize one of them. And I decided to memorize Queen's Gambit. And so whenever I got to play white, I always played Queen's Gambit, always 100% of the time. And I found that I was able to beat the average, like I say, my neighbors or whatever, pretty easily if I was playing white, because I would open with Queen's Gambit and I knew how it worked. And it's a very powerful opening. But notice, so I only learned one opening. And I find that honestly, if Christians can learn one approach with the Mormons, one approach with the Jehovah's Witnesses, I have a blog entitled A Question Jehovah's Witnesses Can't Answer, by the way, at clayjones.net. There you go. But if they just know one opening, one way of this is going to be the most significant, the most powerful, that's really all you need to know.
So from your article that you wrote for us that our subscribers can get to online, it's an online exclusive, I know that your present approach that you use with Mormons is from a missionary to Mormons. So why don't you describe that for our listeners?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm reminded of Dirty Harry and the Dirty Harry movies of long ago, saying a man's got to know his limitations. You know, I never considered myself an expert on Mormons, but I was going to teach on Mormonism, LDS, whatever. And I decided, you know, why don't I contact who's probably the greatest missionary to Mormons ever. The couple was Gerald and Sandra Tanner who founded the Utah Lighthouse Ministry. And so I was very pleased. I thought, you know what? I'm going to ask Sandra Tanner, her husband passed away, had already passed away. I'm going to ask Sandra Tanner, what would she do? And so I said to her, what would you do if a Mormon came to your door? And now, no, of course, again, she's an expert. She's also, and I list her approach in what you're posting, Melanie. The site is there. The reference is there. The URL, there's the word that I needed, is there for her own post on this. But anyway, so I just thought, you know, what would she do? And that's, anyway, so that's where I came up with this.
So given that, how do you approach evangelism to someone who is LDS?
Well, like I say, I got this from Sandra Tanner originally, but what I do is I'll say, why do you believe Mormonism's true? And that's an interesting question, because the Mormons then will reply with something like, oh, you know, I mean, my life is better since I became a Mormon, and that's just wonderful. And I'll go, well, my life's better too, since I became a Christian. So I'll say, but so why do you think Mormonism is true? Oh, wow, we just have send missionaries all over the world. And I'll go, well, we Christians send missionaries all over the world too. So why do you think Mormonism's true? And they'll go, well, you know, we're really big on helping the family and helping families to get healthier and have a robust relationship. And I'll go, well, we Christians do that too. And so whatever they would give me, I could always respond to, well, we Christians do that too. And so then I keep pushing them. And once you push them on this, finally, they'll say something like this. Well, I prayed a prayer and asked God whether or not the Book of Mormon was inspired, or Joseph Smith's a prophet, or something like that. It doesn't have to be the exact words. And I got an inward witness. I got what in some of their documents they call a burning in the bosom. In other words, they got a personal revelation that Mormonism is true. Well, wow, that's a lot, right? Because if you've got a personal revelation from God himself that Mormonism is true, your arguments are going to fall flat to them all the time. Why? Because they got a personal revelation. And so, but then I would say to them, well, okay, fine. But that is subjective, completely subjective. I mean, Shirley MacLaine used to say, I don't know if she still does, but that she could fly around houses, over houses and buildings at night through astral projection. Muslims are blowing themselves up. They're so convinced that Islam is true. Boys sometimes and girls sometimes now think that they should be the opposite sex. How is your belief worth any more than theirs is? And that really is very hard on them.
So that's really interesting, because I think when someone from the LDS church, and you mentioned missionaries, so they do send out young kids like right out of college or right before college or right after college to be missionaries to different places. And there's some in, you know, just your local town or whatever, they'll come to the door. Those are some of the questions that they'll ask Christians, like, how do you know it's true? Have you prayed about it? You know, have you prayed about the Book of Mormon? Do you know it's not true? So once you go through this line of reasoning, because they said, well, we do these things for the family, or, you know, we send out missionaries, and, you know, we have really good, live good lives. How do they usually answer you, you know, once you've gone through all of that? Is there a way that you stump them at all?
It's interesting, because the response, I think every single time, and I used to have a radio program many years ago, and I had some, you know, the president of a local chapter on, the head of a local Mormon church on the radio with me. And I've gone in, you know, Mormons put institutes of religion, usually near university campuses, and I've gone into a couple of those just looking to find Mormons to talk to them. And, you know, I've talked to Mormons at my door too, of course, but their response universally is when you say, so you're saying that you don't trust the scripture when it comes to there only being one God, or that you're saved by grace alone through faith alone, and things like that. You're saying you don't trust them because of a personal subjective experience. Okay, here it is. 100% of the time they respond, that's all you have. And I say, well, no, that's not all I have. My faith is based on the evidence of Jesus being raised from the dead, that the first disciples walked with Jesus, they talked with Jesus, they ate with Jesus. Then they saw Jesus taken, and, you know, by the Romans, well, first by the Jews and then by given over to the Romans. And he was scourged, and then he was crucified, he died, he was buried. And then 3 days later, they saw this man, Jesus, alive again. And again, they talked with him and walked with him and ate with him. And they then began to give their lives for their belief. They saw Jesus raised from the dead. So that's what my faith is based on. My faith is based on the evidence that Jesus really was raised from the dead.
That's interesting. Now, do they say, well, maybe that won't be accurate because of your translation of the Bible? I mean, how do they respond to the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus?
You know, it's really very, very bizarre. And if I encourage you, if you're listening to this, I really encourage, try this. And what you'll start finding is they will argue against the objective evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. They'll begin to express doubt. Well, we really can't, you can't trust the Bible's transmission. And so they actually, it's always bizarre to me to be there talking to a member of the LDS and have them begin to challenge the resurrection of Jesus. It's bizarre. And of course, so anyway, that's very strange. But what they specifically do is they want to challenge the fact that the Bible was accurately transmitted to us, of course, and we already said that earlier, but that's what they're challenging. You really can't trust the Bible's transmission, so you must then be believing it because it's subjective. Well, I'm afraid that's not true, but that's where they go, is they begin to express doubt and begin to challenge the Bible's trustworthiness. Because they want to put you on the same plane as them. And by that, I mean, they want to have it where you're saying, oh, okay, I guess my belief is really as subjective as the Mormons are. Because otherwise, if we have objective reason to believe that Christianity is true, but then the Mormons come along and change it because of subjective personal experiences, that's not, they realize that's not very reliable.
You know, that's interesting because I want to ask you about an article that you wrote for us. Wow, it's been 10 years ago, back in 2013 in our print edition. We published an article by Clay and it was called The Bibliographical Test Updated. And in that article, you know, just the idea of the test, it examines manuscript reliability. And, you know, we've always, Christian apologists obviously have use that test to talk about the reliability of the New Testament. But why don't you tell us about your article, what it talks about the reliability of the New Testament. And, you know, this article is from a decade ago. Is it still relevant today?
Oh, it's surely relevant today. It's entitled The Bibliographical Test Updated. And, well, I'm going to just quote from the beginning. I could kind of ramble around and tell you what it is, but I'm just going to read the first paragraph of the article, because I think I'll be able to get to the point a lot more quickly. The bibliographical test examines manuscript reliability. The bibliographical test compares the closeness of the New Testament's oldest extant manuscripts to the date of the autographs. Now, by extant manuscripts, we mean manuscripts that still exist, the oldest ones that still exist, because a lot of New Testament manuscripts have literally been read to pieces. I mean, where they just were no longer manuscripts. I mean, they were literally read to pieces. Sometimes in some, you know, places, monks would use old manuscripts to light their fires. And that's a sad, sad story. But anyway, that's not for now. So it's the oldest extant manuscript to the date of the autograph. And the autograph is when it was originally penned, when Paul actually put pen to papyrus and wrote it down. That's called the autograph. And so anyway, it compares the oldest extant manuscripts to the date of the autographs and the sheer number of the New Testament's extant manuscripts with the number of and earliness of extant manuscripts of other ancient documents, such as Homer, Aristotle, Herodotus. And since the New Testament manuscripts outstrip every other ancient manuscript in sheer number and proximity to the autographs, the New Testament should be regarded as accurately transmitted. So maybe I can put this another way, but that's how I put it in the article. But just to put it another way, if you're going to say that Homer, for instance, Homer's Iliad has the second largest number of manuscript attestations, and we have like 1,757, I believe, or at least that's what I put in the article. I think it's increased a little bit since then. 1,757 manuscripts of Homer. And manuscript, right, just for everybody's, just to remind you, a manu means it was actually handwritten. That's what we mean by manuscript. It was, so we had 757 of Homer's Iliad. By comparison, we have closing in on 6,000 Greek manuscripts of the New Testament. Then we have about 10,000 Latin manuscripts of the New Testament. Then there's 5,000 or 6,000 Slavic manuscripts, and on and on and on and on it goes. So that when you put it all together, the attestation of the New Testament when it comes to manuscripts and the earliness of our oldest extant manuscript and how close they were to the autographs is you have to throw out basically every single other work of history and say we can't trust any of them. Because the New Testament, when you compare the manuscripts and in number and proximity to the autographs, the New Testament beats their pants off. I mean, it's not even close. Like I say, we have thousands and thousands and thousands of manuscripts in Greek, Latin, Slavic, and a whole bunch of other languages that I go through in the article, thousands and thousands of them. And there's only 1,757 of Homer's Iliad. And that is the second most attested to book there is in the world. So if you're going to say, well, I can't trust the transmission of the New Testament, you then need to say, well, and you can't trust, then you can't trust any ancient manuscript. You can't trust any of them. By the way, John Warwick Montgomery likes to tell the story. He was debating, you know, a lot of apologists today wouldn't know who he is, but he was one of the most famous apologists back in the day and had a lot of effect on this generation's apologists. Anyway, me included. But he was debating Avram Stroll, atheist Avram Stroll, and he told Avram Stroll, he says, he presented this argument. He says, you're going to have to throw out all you know about the ancient world. And Avram Stroll said, at the University of British Columbia, said, all right, I'll throw out all my knowledge of the ancient world. See the pressure that put on Avram Stroll in that debate. At that point, Montgomery loves to tell the story. The chairman of the history department all of a sudden blurted out, good Lord, Avram, not that. I mean, you're not really going to say we know nothing about history. But that's what you really have to do. You get into this terrible bind that we really can't trust history at all. There's nothing in history to trust. Because if you're not going to accept the manuscript attestation and transmission of the New Testament, then you can't accept anything else either. And I think that's a very, very sound argument. And one, anyways, I like pointing that out, of course, to Mormons. Mormons don't do well with that. They really don't know what to do. But I had, as a matter of fact, I had a Mormon neighbor about 8 or 9, 10 years ago, and he read Bart Ehrman's works because he wanted to beef up his ability to argue against the transmission and reliability of the New Testament. That's where these people are going, that they're actually studying this stuff, studying skeptics, so that they, in case somebody says, well, the New Testament has been reliably transmitted, which, by the way, it has. So that's their way of getting out of it. Then you're going to have to, this seems really self-serving. All I would say is I would encourage you, if you get into this bind, go and see my article in the Christian Research Journal, The Bibliographical Test Updated, because I think it will give you the ammo that you need to say, no, the New Testament has been accurately translated. And here's the problem. If the New Testament has been accurately transmitted, then Mormonism is false. Because the doctrines that, well, we went through a bunch of them, but the doctrines that Mormons hold, like there's many gods, or that you're saved by, you know, grace after all you can do, and things like that, all that falls apart. And I've debated, when I was debating these Mormon leaders on the radio, they really became incredibly, obviously flustered about this, because they really didn't have any kind of a good answer to that.
Now, we talked earlier about the Book of Mormon. Do you think some of these tests could be applied to the Book of Mormon, and would it pass them?
That's a good question. And the answer is, and this is something Gerald and Sandra Tanner put out a lot on this. The Book of Mormon has been revised again and again and again. And if you Google it, say maybe Google something like revisions to the Book of Mormon, you'll see that it has been changed over the years. But also, one of the troubles with the Book of Mormon, and this is the same problem you have with Islam, is there's only one custodian really in charge of keeping the Book of Mormon safe. And that's, you know, the LDS Church. They're the ones keeping charge of it. If they want to make a change, they can do that. And that's the same problem, by the way, that Muslims have. They go, well, see, we don't have all these different readings that you have. Well, the different readings that we have are, one, tiny, and two, it's because we have thousands upon thousands of manuscripts. But when it comes to the Quran, there's only one manuscript because what? The House of Saud is not going to let anybody, they're in charge. And so the argument that well, we have better custody and thus a document that hasn't been altered very much, well, that just doesn't, that's not going to fly. It doesn't fly. So anyway, I think that's a really interesting thing. By the way, I use the same argument that I use on Muslims that I use on Mormons. And that is, why do you believe Islam is true? And once you get down to it, if you keep pushing them, they're going to say, because of the inimitability of the Quran. What do they mean by that? That the Quran is such a perfect work that it's just excels any other work in the history of literature. It's that wonderful. But notice that that is subjective. That a Muslim in reading the Quran would go, this is the most beautiful work in the history of the world. That's subjective. I've read a lot of the Quran, and I certainly don't think it's even close to being the most beautiful of anything. There's all kinds of bizarre passages in it that don't make sense, like, you know, that suggests that maybe you need to occasionally beat your wife. So anyway, I think it's fascinating that you're in the same situation with Muslims and with Mormons. By the way, one more thing about this, both Islam, you know, I mean, Joseph Smith had the original when he was 15 appearance of who he said was God the Father and Jesus Christ. But then it was just a few years later that he got this appearance from an angel who told him that there was this book that he needed to have. And that's how Mormonism came about. Similar with Islam, an angel, he says an angel came and told him what to put in the Quran. I think it was the same angel. And for a cheap shot, I think it was probably named Moroni, although even in Islam, even though Muhammad, all of a sudden, you know, Muhammad doesn't say this, but because Moroni is very close to moron. And I think that it was, honestly, this is just a satanic appearance to both Muhammad and to Joseph Smith, dressing themselves up as an angel. And we're not supposed to trust that.
Well, that is very fascinating. And again, I want to encourage folks to go and look at Clay's 2013 article, which is free on our website, equip.org, the bibliographic test updated, because it's going to really equip you, not just with Mormonism, but with other religious groups who have similar claims and their own religious work doesn't stand up to what we have for the Bible. Well, finally, I have a fun rapid-fire question for Clay. Clay, Easter is coming up. Do you and your wife have any particular Easter celebration traditions that you celebrate?
Just getting together with family. My family does Easter egg hunts. Obviously, I don't participate. I'm not a big fan, personally, of Easter egg hunts because it's kind of a fertility thing more than anything else. But whatever. The Greeks, I know the Greeks, when they do Easter, by the way, they have one egg, one hard-boiled egg at each plate, but it's dyed blood red. And I kind of get a kick out of that. Anyway, that's it. We'll be getting together with family. And no, Jeannie and I won't be looking for Easter eggs. One other thing about that, by the way, although I don't really think it's a good idea, I don't see what Easter eggs have to do with the resurrection of Jesus. I don't make a big deal about it with my family because, frankly, it's just too small an issue. There's a lot of big, big issues that I'm trying to work on with some of my family members, and that's just not important enough.
Well, thanks, Clay, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Sorry, I turned that into a serious, I turned that into a teachable moment, Melanie. But anyway, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And I'm glad you did turn it. It's usually rapid fire, but I bet people have similar questions about how to handle some of those non-religious holiday traditions and how to navigate those. So that was helpful. Thank you for being on.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
You've been listening to episode 333 of the Postmodern Realities podcast, and it's brought to you by the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Dr. Clay Jones. He has written an online exclusive effective evangelism article for our journal. His article is called A Question Mormons Can't Answer, and our subscribers can read his article for free at our website, equip.org. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that, and every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.